One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Novak, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Japan's government says it will treat radioactive wastewater from the damaged Fukushima nuclear center and pipe it into the sea. The plan, announced this week, includes guidelines for compensation to be paid to local businesses affected by the release. The radioactive water will be treated and diluted before being released into the Pacific Ocean. The plan calls on the International Atomic Energy Agency to complete a report on its findings about the safety of the treated water. Fishermen and people living in the area have opposed the release of more than 1 million tons of water beginning in the spring of 2023. Neighboring China and South Korea have also objected to the plan. Japan has said the water release is necessary to move forward with cleanup efforts at the Fukushima Center. Three reactors there suffered meltdowns after the 2011 earthquake, and huge ocean waves destroyed the plant's cooling systems. The disaster forced 160,000 people to flee nearby areas poisoned by radioactive material. The nuclear center's operator, known as TEPCO, has said Fukushima was running out of storage space for radioactive water. It released detailed plans earlier this month for the water release. They included the building of an underground passage or tunnel from the factory to the ocean. The tunnel is expected to be about a kilometer long and 2.5 meters around. The treated water will flow through the tunnel to the sea. The Japanese government says the ocean release is the most realistic way to solve the water storage problem. Other methods considered included injecting the water into the ground or converting it to steam or hydrogen and then releasing it into the atmosphere. The government describes the water to be released as treated and not radioactive. But experts say it is impossible to remove all the radioactivity. TEPCO and government officials say tritium, a radioactive form of hydrogen, is the only substance that cannot be removed from the water. They say tritium is not considered harmful in small amounts. I'm Brian Lynn.
As a presidential candidate,
Joe Biden criticized the administration of then-President Donald Trump for its immigration policies. Biden also promised to pass reforms to permit more asylum seekers and refugees. However, Biden's immigration policies in 2021 have not changed too much from those of the earlier administration. The biggest change was that Biden stopped building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The Biden administration has kept enforcing what is called Title 42. That law requires the quick removal of migrants as a public health concern. Biden also tried to change a policy that required asylum seekers at the southern border to stay in Mexico while waiting for U.S. immigration court dates. But a federal court ruled that the law, called the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, must stay in place. Immigrant supporters say Biden has made the U.S. immigration system kinder, but they credit him with little else. Fernando Garcia is director of the Border Network for Human Rights. He told VOA that we can still see some of the kind of legacy of Trump at the border. That has not changed, and we're disappointed that that is still happening. In addition to stopping border wall construction, Biden ordered an end to the stay in Mexico policy soon after entering office. Texas, a U.S. state bordering Mexico, took legal action against the Biden administration to keep the policy. In August, a federal judge ordered the policy to remain in place. The Biden administration is appealing the ruling, but the policy was restarted on December 6th, after Mexico agreed to receive returned migrants. The Biden administration has sought to end the MPP policy, but it has observed Title 42 rules related to public health. Since March 20, 2020, thousands of migrants seeking to apply for asylum in the United States have been sent back to their home countries. But there have been some changes to Title 42 under Biden to permit unaccompanied children and families with young children to stay. Former President Trump reduced the number of refugees permitted in the U.S. from 85,000 to 15,000. Biden at first kept the refugee limit at 15,000, the lowest in modern U.S. history. After many Democrats criticized the decision, the administration raised the limit to 62,500. From October 2020 to the end of September, the U.S. has admitted just 11,411 refugees. The administration has since raised the 2022 refugee limit to 125,000. But the administration has said the goal of 125,000 admissions will be hard to hit. Researchers say little has changed in federal border enforcement. Jessica Bolter is an expert with the Migration Policy Institute. She said the Biden administration is centered on removing undocumented immigrants that are a threat to public safety. During the Trump administration, any undocumented immigrant living in the U.S. could be removed. Bolter said the change has made most immigrants who do not have legal papers to be living in the U.S. less likely to be removed. The Biden administration has worked to prevent immigration, customs, and enforcement officers from making arrests at courthouses. Biden has also limited detentions of pregnant women. After more than a year of closures, U.S. embassies and consulates around the world have reopened for visa processing. However, services remain limited because of the pandemic. In November, the U.S. State Department announced that more than 460,000 people are awaiting required meetings with officials. There is already a long list of those applying to live in the U.S. legally. On his first day in office, President Biden released an immigration reform bill, the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. It includes an 8-year path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. The bill has never been voted on by either the U.S. House or Senate. It is not expected to pass. Since the Democratic Party controls the presidency and Congress, the inability to reform America's immigration system is hard to accept for immigration activists. Our hope, our demand, and our expectation were that this new administration was bringing a new air in regard to immigrants and immigration policy, with a more humane approach to immigration, and we did believe that, Garcia from Border Network for Human Rights told VOA. I'm Dan Novak.
As 2021 comes to an end, we leave behind a wonderful year of English grammar. This year, we explored many areas: adjectives, phrasal verbs, determiners, and more. We also explored many areas of popular culture, films, songs, and even sports. But one theme stood out this past year: the passing of the seasons. With the changing seasons and the passing of days, the Everyday Grammar team explored the connections between grammar and time. As 2021 comes to an end, let's explore how the passing seasons played an important part in our programming this year. With the arrival of spring in 2021, the Everyday Grammar team wrote about phrasal verbs with the term spring. Examples included spring on, spring from, and spring up. All of these phrasal verbs have different meanings, but the central point of that report was to show you how these phrasal verbs, and the noun spring, the season, carry or suggest the idea of a beginning, growth, movement, or change. In North America's summer months, we did 3 reports that had some connection with the season. These included verbs and summer weather, grammar for rest and relaxation, and grammar for planning summer trips. In terms of verbs, linking verbs played an important part in the way we taught how to describe summer weather. These linking verbs included feel, look, and get. As in, it feels humid, the clouds look scary, or it's getting hot. In our grammar and relaxation report, we explored the structure have plus a noun phrase, as in have lunch, have plans, or have a blast, meaning to have a lot of fun. And in our planning summer trips report, we explored how Americans talk about future time, will and be going to. The seasonal change to autumn, also known as fall, gave the Everyday Grammar team a chance to explore descriptions. Descriptions are important for autumn. It is a time of wonderful colors, cooler temperatures, and tasty seasonal treats. We explored adjectives, noun phrases, and determiners. We taught how to create descriptions of a happy fall day. As our year comes to an end, you might wonder about our current season in the United States: winter. Winter is a time of cold temperatures, gray skies, and yet warm feelings and celebrations, such as Christmas and the New Year. We will end this report with a question for our readers and listeners around the world.
If you had to connect the winter season with a subject within grammar, what subject would that be? Why? The Everyday Grammar team connected spring with phrasal verbs, summer with linking verbs, and fall with adjectives. But what about winter? Let us know what you think in the comments section of our website. And have a safe, healthy, and happy 2022. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation. But administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, the smell of their bodies will force Congress to act." Coxie tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxie, were arrested. A judge found Coxie guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxie's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxie's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay. Yet, Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So, railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them, and no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.